Maggie Bob Kessler. It's John Williams. This is WGN Radio. How are you? This should be a nicer day than maybe it's going to be for the next couple of hours. We'll talk a little bit about what didn't happen yesterday. We'll do some of our usual features as well, though, and those are fun. Our Vibe Score segment is where we will score the news, everything from hairdos to harebrained ideas. And we'll also talk to the boys from The Beat in the 2 o'clock hour. That's a little sports talk. Sonia Soraya from Salon has been a guest on this show before. And we'll talk a little bit about what's new in TV. That'll be in our 2 o'clock hour. And The Mincing Rascals is our roundtable discussion that this time focuses on some of the shenanigans downstate. We'll get to that in a little bit. We're joined in studio by Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune and also from WGN Radio. Rick, how are you?
I'm good, John. Good to be with you.
I haven't talked to you in a while. It's good to hear your voice. You've been well?
I've been busy, that's for sure.
Yeah, I know. What a stupid question. I hope you've been well, but I sure do know you've been busy. I have to tell you, I talked to a friend of mine in Minnesota today, and he said, "Hey, John, tell the people in Chicago, good job yesterday." And I said, "You know, I don't know that that's how everybody feels about what happened over at UIC." What happened over there, Rick?
Well, I think you had, this is kind of the early front page of the early Sunday front page of the Tribune is the collision of the great divide that exists in American politics today. A disaffected right wing that is supporting Donald Trump and a dissatisfied left wing, largely supporters of Bernie Sanders. And it all came together at the University of Illinois Chicago. And
is it understood that that's exactly what it was, an organized Sanders effort to thwart Trump's rally?
I would not say it was an organized Sanders effort, but it certainly was an organized effort by a number of different groups. A lot of the members of those groups, I mean, when the announcement was made that the event was canceled, a number of the protesters started chanting "Bernie, Bernie, Bernie," and of course the protest crowd was really kind of representative of those supporting Sanders, who are those younger voters that we've seen supporting him largely over Hillary Clinton in these early primary states.
I don't know what to make of the notion that it was or wasn't organized. I don't know that that discounts the, you know, authenticity of the people that are there, if they were organized or not. Should we make much of that point?
Well, Donald Trump this morning in near Dayton, Ohio, the first public appearance he made since the cancellation, accused this of being a planned attack by professional protesters. A number of people responding on social media to the activities going on in Chicago last night, a number of Trump supporters or Republicans or anti-protesters were alleging how, you know, Chicago's known for having a history of paid protesters.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, sometimes they hire people to hand out or to hold signs, you know, like employees that are mad at their employer. Sometimes the guy standing there holding the sign is making $8 an hour.
Yeah, we have. Well, but at the same time, you know, there was those stories about Trump, a Trump event where actors were paid to come and help fill the audience.
Yeah, but this felt true. I mean, if it was organized to some degree, I think. And didn't you feel this one coming, Rick?
Absolutely.
Were you surprised? No,
I was not surprised. And in fact, you know, there when this was first announced, I felt a great deal of trepidation because you knew this kind of combustible atmosphere was going to exist. And certainly from the moment it was announced, there were all kinds of different ways that the anti-Trump protesters were responding. A number of them went on the internet and grabbed up tickets, and some of them to just take them away from Trump supporters who wanted to go and not fill the audience. Others, of course, there were, I think, about five sections of the pavilion at UIC that were filled with protesters.
Trump said that he consulted with police. Our Bob Kessler and others, though, have been reporting that the police say they weren't consulted. It wasn't their advice to cancel the rally. They rather felt like they would be able to contain it, at least at the point where it got canceled. I don't know. Maybe they do feel like they could have contained it, but I don't think this was a bad idea to cancel the rally.
I don't think so either. And, you know, at the point where it was announced that it was canceled, it actually was relatively calm inside the arena because people were waiting for Trump to speak. And now a number of people, about a dozen or so, had been of the protesters had been let out at after one guy raised a torn up Trump sign. And but you knew kind of early on what this was going to be like.
And you know, it also raises questions too about what the obligation of the city's police is in a situation like this. This is what happened in Valdosta, Georgia, and a number of other venues, South Carolina. You can go anywhere across the country where these rallies have been, especially lately. The police are called upon to remove people that protest in a public place. I want everybody to be safe, but I think if I want to hold up a torn sign and I have a ticket to be there, or if I want to wear a T-shirt that says, Salam, I come in peace, I should have the right to do that. And I don't know that just because it makes Trump or those people upset that the tax-supported police officers have to usher me away at the behest of the campaign. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. And, in fact, after the cancellation, Trump was on MSNBC saying that, you know, it's he can't believe that his First Amendment rights were taken away. And it's he's the one who decided to cancel the rally because he didn't like others' First Amendment rights.
Well, I still think that was probably a good idea, but there's a couple of questions for you. Rick Pearson's on the line from the Chicago Tribune. You hear him on WGN Radio, too. And Griffin, our producer, we're going to start with, I think, Karen, and you guys are going to pop the calls up, right? So, Karen, you go first. You're on WGN. Hi.
Hi. Did it ever occur to you that this was all planned by the Trump Organization? Why else would they put it in a downtown college campus with good transportation that is diverse and happens to be right next door to Pilsen, which is a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood? And meanwhile, Trump can sit back at Trump Hotel or whatever and relax and do nothing and whine and complain about how everyone is mean to him.
Yeah, and it almost seemed like he's above
the
fray.
Police. And I'm with you. I don't disbelieve the police in this case. You know, they have no reason, and it would be too easily proved to be, you know.
Your question to my producer, too, if I may, your question to my producer, too, was, does what happened in Chicago yesterday help or hurt Donald Trump's campaign? Rick Pearson, what's your answer to that?
I think that's an unknown question. One, I think the fact of, given Trump's rhetoric, his calls to ban Muslim immigration, his build the wall and have Mexico pay for it, those kinds of things, certainly when you have an audience of diverse urban minority component, that could embolden Trump support among some of those voters that he has courted with that kind of rhetoric. But at the same time, when you look at, you know, Republicans did that famous autopsy after Mitt Romney's loss, and the autopsy results were that we need to reach out and grow the party, and it could, you know, put in people's minds, Republican minds, can this guy actually win with that kind of rhetoric when we want to make America and Republicanism a bigger party?
I'm going to pause here. Give me one more minute, Rick. We have a couple of people on the line, some of whom were at the rally last night, or the non-rally. I guess it started and then stopped.
The event.
By the way, yeah, no kidding. The main event, the main card. Also at the rally in Ohio then today, somebody approached Trump maybe menacingly on the stage. He was missed away. The Secret Service stepped Trump back. He said, I could have handled him, but it's better to let the cops handle this. And everybody cheered because they would have loved to see Trump just pop this guy in the nose. And it's that kind of rhetoric that has, I think, a lot of us thought been sowing the seeds for what almost happened or did happen in Chicago yesterday. Rick Pearson's in the studio. We'll pause here and talk to a witness and may take more of your calls. 312-981-7200. This is WGN. Again, Rick Pearson is here. Rick, we have on a phone line right now somebody who was at UIC yesterday. It's Gayatri Sanku. Gayatri, are you there?
Hi, yes, I am.
What did you go there for? Were you curious? Were you a protester? Were you one of the planned protesters? What were you doing there, Gayatri?
So I was one of the protesters. I actually represent the School of Public Health, and we were there for basically protesting everything that Mr. Trump has said towards students of color. And we were really determined to prove that he cannot buy space at our university and also expect to buy students' presence there as well. So that's what I was there for. And I was very appalled to see that there were so many students that had come to really protest everything that Mr. Trump has been saying in the past few months.
Wait a minute. You were appalled to see that the students were doing that? That's what you were doing?
Yeah, I was appalled because usually UIC students have taken to different forms of media to protest Mr. Trump. I was really happy to see, though, that everyone really came out to show that they were not happy with things that he was saying. And I know that the media has been covering this as an event that was, put on by an outside source, but it really wasn't. It was entirely student-led. Different student organizations, the Muslim Student Association, the School of Public Health, Public Health Student Association, the student government, everyone was sending representatives to the protest to make sure that everyone knew the students weren't happy with what was going on.
All right. You're appalled at Trump. You were happy to see the students there. Are you Muslim?
No, I'm actually a Hindu, but a lot of my Muslim friends were there.
Yeah. Were you inside the pavilion or outside?
I was inside the pavilion.
What was that like, Gayatri? I mean, what I saw, it looked rather chaotic, but I only saw maybe the moment when it was announced that the rally wasn't going to go forward. I wonder what would have happened if that rally had gone forth. Was there anything particularly planned, or were you all going to chant? What were you going to do as Trump spoke?
So we actually had an organized effort to disrupt Mr. Trump's speech throughout the entire event. So we were hoping to have different groups have a different chant every 10 minutes representing different causes that were affecting students. So our chant was going to be talking about the Black Lives Matter movement, and we were going to be really advocating for the fact that Black and Brown lives matter. Other chants were directed around healthcare. There were a lot of medical students there as well, talking about how much the new healthcare plan that Mr. Trump is proposing is not actually going to adequately address the healthcare needs of underprivileged.
Let me ask you this, Gayatri. I wonder, and maybe Rick, you know the answer to this. I wonder what the ratio of protesters to supporters was going to be at that rally. Do either of you have any sense of that?
At least I saw that there were maybe at least 1,000 students out there in the protest alone, inside the pavilion, that were against Mr. Trump.
I mean, inside there were more Trump supporters than there were protesters. But then outside, you had thousands of people outside the pavilion protesting.
It's funny, though, Gayatri. I get the feeling that if you all had started that, you would have disrupted the speech. I wonder if you wouldn't have also disrupted your nose. You know what I mean? I think that could have really ended violently or badly.
Well, one thing that I really didn't agree with the media was that the media was really portraying it as if the protesters were starting the fight. I was in the front row of the student section that was protesting, and I did not see a single fight initiated by a protester. Almost everyone there that was initiating a fight was a Trump supporter, and that is something that the media is not covering.
I'm curious, what media is saying that the protesters were starting the fight? What media is saying that?
Well, the media has really been trying to show
what media? What media outlet is saying that the protesters started the fight?
I believe that Fox News has been proposing it as if the protesters have been.
Okay, because the media encompasses a lot of different things. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So people don't like to generalize. Okay,
and by the way, by starting a fight, what do you mean exactly? Because, well, I know a very small number of people, relative to what could have happened there, were arrested or injured. It sounded like it actually did not get out of hand. Were there fights, actual physical or pushing fights on the floor?
There were maybe one or two physical fights, but there was not as much as media outlets like Fox News or even CNN were covering, as if it was some horrendous bloodbath. It was really not like that. It was one or two small altercations. It was nothing of the scale that they were speaking of.
Gayatri Sanku is a graduate student at UIC. Gayatri, I'm really glad you could join us. Thanks for your time this afternoon.
Thank you.
Rick, I have to pause for the news. Anything else you want to insert, ask, or suggest here?
No, I just I think we go back to that fundamental question that the caller asked about, does this help or hurt Trump? And I think really, you know, this has reverberations for the entire campaign and on both sides, both parties. And it's just going to be interesting to see how this dynamic plays out. But Trump is not showing any signs of backing off that rhetoric that people are concerned about.
And you hear the volume of his supporters when stuff like this happens, when a protester gets punched or carried out. And I think it just doubles the resolve.
Well, as Trump talked about this in near Dayton today, one of his supporters yelled out, "Expletive Chicago."
Yeah.
And the crowd cheered.
Yeah, if there's a giant meter somewhere in the sky and it's the Trumpometer, I think the Trumpometer went a little more to the right today. I think it helped what happened in Chicago yesterday. There's nothing so inviting as coming to the aid of a victim. And for once, Trump looks like the victim here when people rush the stage or try and shut him down. That's something he hasn't had to deal with before, but it's just another unpredictable layer for him. And on that, I got to let you go, man. It's good to hear you. It's good to read you. You're on tomorrow, right, Rick?
Yes, tomorrow, 7 to 9. And obviously, we'll be talking about this and so much more as we get into Tuesday's primary election.
Yeah. All right, Rick, thanks for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, John.
Rick Pearson from WGN and the Chicago Tribune. We'll pause here, update you on the news from Bob Kessler. That's next on WGN Radio. All right, thank you for that, Bob Kessler. This is John Williams. So the Mincing Rascals podcast is something you can subscribe to. You can subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes, or you can hear it here at WGNplus.com, and we feature part of it on our Saturday show. It's a roundtable where we talk about news, both the presidential type, but also state and local as well, with Kristen McQuarrie from the Chicago Tribune, Eric Zorn, the columnist from the Tribune, and our own Steve Bertrand. I believe this excerpt starts with Steve Bertrand saying,
"Are you following the Duncan race at all?
Why is Barack Obama endorsing Juliana Stratton for the Illinois 5th House District over the incumbent?"
I heard this morning there's been nearly $5 million spent on that.
Is it $5 million now?
It was over $4 million. It was over $4 million.
It was three, yeah.
And that they expect there to be 10,000 votes in that primary.
They could just give everybody a check. It's really about Madigan wants this Duncan out because Duncan didn't always vote with the rest of the state's Democratic Party. But that's Madigan's business. Why is Barack Obama carrying the bucket for Mike Madigan?
Certainly one reason is that Duncan kind of did a little preening during Obama's speech on February 10th when he was down in Springfield. He was talking about the importance of bipartisanship and working with the other party. Duncan stands up and goes, "Yeah, heck yeah," I think is what he said. And Obama sort of turned to him and said, "You know, we'll talk later, Duncan, sit down." And Duncan then took that "we'll talk later" segment and used it in a radio commercial that made it sound like Obama was endorsing Duncan. And this race is really important because it is a proxy battle between the Rauner-backed forces and the Madigan-backed forces. I mean, there's PACs involved and so on, but that's essentially what it is. And Duncan did break with the Democrats. He's not the only Democrat who's broken, but he's the only one who's become a target because he did it in such a strange and opportunistic way. It didn't seem to be a principled vote against Madigan. It just seemed to be like he was just trying to go off and get his own.
Wasn't there one huge issue that he bucked the trend on? Wasn't it a big one?
He skipped a vote that they needed the 71st vote to override Rauner's veto of this bill that would have kind of decreased Rauner's ability to negotiate with AFSCME. So
he was the vote that thwarted Madigan.
Pretty much. He was in New York. Right. He didn't even come. It was in December. They all came. I think it was December or September. They all came back to override this vote.
Including one of the reps who was on her deathbed, right? She subsequently died.
Yes.
All that explains why Madigan doesn't like this guy. But was it his personal antics that got Obama into it then, do you think, Eric?
I think it might have been. I mean, he obviously has roots here. It's not like he's going into some random state. He served in the General Assembly, so he knows these people. He may even know Duncan. I'm not sure.
Duncan said they were good pals.
Well, then
that's Duncan.
Not anymore.
right.
And this really is about if Madigan cannot keep cannot oust Duncan, who openly defied. I mean, it was a quiet defiance at first, and then it became an open defiance. He's now saying that he believes in the people. He doesn't believe in. He called Madigan's style of politics plantation politics. So he has really thrown down a challenge to Madigan. If he can, and this is a heavily Democratic district. It went like 80-20 for Pat Quinn last time. So this is, and if Madigan can't exercise any control over exercise the control over this district of getting out somebody who is openly defending
him. But that's
not
Madigan's district.
It's not Madigan's district, but it's Madigan's house, right?
It's, I mean, it's his veto-proof majority, yeah.
I got to tell you, do you hear yourself, Eric? I mean, he doesn't get to do that. The local voters get to pick their local person, and that the president of the United States, at the behest of the speaker,
ask the same question about. Well, ask the same question about Bruce Rauner. Rauner's doing the same thing. Rauner doesn't live there either. Bruce Rauner and all these Republican PACs that are back Duncan, they don't live there either.
I mean, I think it's legitimately strange that the leader of the free world takes time out of his day to cut a television ad for a local house race in Illinois. I mean, I think part of it is...
Of the same party, even.
Of the same party.
Because they see... everybody sees this as a really pivotal... This is the most important election, I think. The most important primary election in ages.
To Madigan.
Madigan screwed Obama at every turn when he was first running for office, when he first ran for U.S. Senate. Why would Obama in any way try to help out the speaker by doing this?
Because this also plays into a whole larger story about Republican control of state houses around the country and about what the direction of the states. I mean, Rauner's trying to take our
state. A Democrat is going to win that seat. A Democrat is going to win that seat.
But is it going to be a Democrat who votes like a Democrat or a Democrat who votes like a Republican?
Duncan doesn't really do that, does he?
No. Duncan has been a... I can't point to one vote he's taken in the past 12 years that has not been party line. He was the leader of the Legislative Black Caucus for a while.
But wait, why are we surprised that if a guy thumps the speaker in a huge vote, that the speaker's not going to come back and get him? I mean, that's not surprising. That's a party thing.
Come back and get him. What does that mean, Steve? Come back and get him.
He's going to put one of his own people in there to replace him. I mean, that's what.
You can't do that.
Of course you can. That's what. What are you talking? Why do you think? Why do you think in Washington there's a Senate? There's a Senate campaign committee for the Republicans and the Democrats because the party is trying to build a majority in people around the country. The speaker is trying to build his majority and his people around the state.
He will not tolerate any dissent,
that's different. It's just a little dissent.
It's a big dissent.
Kristen, he didn't.
He's not swapping parties.
He tolerates Jack Franks. You know, nobody's running against Jack Franks. He's one of those.
Right, and in D.C., the speaker tolerates the Freedom Caucus, and pushback should be welcomed. I mean, the fact that the speaker wants to take out Duncan because he's a little rebellious.
He's a lot rebellious, and now he's going to be bought and paid for
he's
by
not,
Rauner.
But that's actually not true. He missed that. He's not an override vote, but Madigan still has, what, a 19-seat majority?
Is he taking money from Rauner's PACs or PACs associated with Rauner?
Yes.
Is he?
Absolutely.
It's a really important...
He could turn the money down, Steve.
And by the same token, Rauner is going after McCann, who's an incumbent Republican state senator in the Springfield area. He's going after him because McCann doesn't vote with Rauner on labor issues. You know, and that's legitimate, I think, for him.
Party politics.
Yeah, it is.
If I was in those districts, particularly Duncan's, I would feel so manipulated, such a pawn, or I'd be watching my representative being a pawn to some bigger machine. It is a spectacle.
I agree with that. I think we can all agree around the table on that.
That last voice is Eric Zorns, of course, columnist for the Chicago Tribune. The female there is our friend Kristen McQuarrie. She writes editorials for the Chicago Tribune. And I think what Eric and Kristen had to say in that podcast this week about the validity of the message or of what the Trump supporters are hearing was really fascinating. And I think that message needs to be heard. We'll give you that little taste from our Mincing Rascals podcast next on WGN. This is John Williams on WGN, part two of our Mincing Rascals podcast replay in just a second. Kevin heard something in part one he wanted to comment on. Kevin, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hey, John. Great, great topic. Love the show.
Thank you, sir.
Generally, I think, unfortunately, what it's becoming with these politicians, both Madigan and Obama and whomever, I really think it's becoming more of a personal thing where, like, they're not going to let I'm not going to let somebody talk to me about that, about something, or go against me. It's really kind of a something where it's an ego thing. And whether it's the right candidate or the wrong candidate, somebody says something against Obama in a forum, and he makes his decision that I'm going to spend my time that should be spent on domestic issues. We have so many international issues to spend time to record a television commercial. I think we're just way out of place on priorities.
I didn't think that this conversation that I was having with the gang was going to go there. And all of a sudden, I'm like, wait a minute. Listen to what we're saying. We're saying that Mike Madigan and the party elite in Illinois are not going to let this guy get reelected. And they all looked at me like I'm some sort of naive oaf. Like, yeah, that's how it's done. And I'm thinking, I know that's how it's done, but hit pause for a second and just listen to us. They're going to say that guy over there can't have the office that maybe the people in his district want him to have.
Right. And for a long time, I'm sorry to interrupt, for a long time, that's the way it's been done. And maybe something has to change.
Yeah. Kevin, I got to let you go. I'm glad you're listening.
All
thanks
right.
for the call, man. Have a great day, too. So speaking of change or not, I mean, so here's just another excerpt. We always talk presidential politics on the Mincing Rascals podcast. And at one point, Eric and Kristen particularly were talking about the supporters of Trump. And this is where Eric Zorn was speaking.
It's going to be really difficult for the party to deny Trump the nomination if he comes to Cleveland.
They can't do it. They cannot do that. I mean,
why
that,
do you say that? Well,
because,
they can.
Because people are legitimately voting for him, for the Republican Party establishment, which is what all these people are rebelling against, to swoop in and try to erase what is actually a movement. This is not just people who like Donald Trump. This is a movement on the Republican side, just like Bernie Sanders is a movement on the Democratic side. For the establishment to come in and do that would be devastating.
But why do you think they would do that, Kristen? Why?
I don't think they would.
Think they're going to try?
What do you think the motivation is for this whole conversation, Kristen? I mean, why does that conversation even exist?
Which conversation?
Is it because they hate the brokered convention? Is it because they hate Trump so much and what he's done to the party?
Because they don't think Trump can beat Hillary Clinton.
I get that. I don't blame them for doing that. You say, oh, my God, we can't do it. Well, the kids are going to wreck it if they vote for Trump, because then you'll have President Hillary Clinton.
Okay,
if they
choose someone else, the kids are going to wreck it too, because the people who voted for Trump are not going to vote for the somebody else in November, probably, right? So they're maybe doomed both either way. So although I think Trump could easily win, but the question is, what does more damage to the party long-term for the next election?
You're exactly right,
Steve.
I think that's the question. Is the party more damaged by Donald Trump at the head of the ticket this year, or is it more damaged if by the tumult at the convention followed by an establishment choice? It's not impossible to think that someone like a Ryan or a Romney could come in and run a quick, hard campaign. People don't love Hillary Clinton. I mean, she's going to have a hard time.
All those people who showed up at their polling places or who caucused for Trump or one of the other Republican candidates would completely rebel if the establishment swoops in and tries to basically erase the democratic process. I would be outraged. The rise of Trump is because the GOP establishment has ignored the party and has not advanced policy positions that they promised to take on the campaign trail. And people are ticked off about it. And that's why they're voting for Donald Trump.
Technically, they're not voting for Trump, right? We're voting for delegates. Delegates
to
the
convention. You're going to play that card?
Excuse
well,
me.
Wait a minute.
No. Sit down class here.
Just give me 20 more seconds.
Man.
I don't even want to. But they're voting for delegates to the convention who are going to decide who wins.
You tell that to people. Okay, I'm sorry.
Right?
I'm interrupting.
Yeah. So what's the point of that, Steve?
So it's just a little more cover if they're voting for delegates and the delegates can't vote for Trump.
Trump is drawing crowds of 20 to 30,000 people wherever he goes.
They're hateful spectacles. They're shameful spectacles.
You can't paint with a broad brush like that, John. I mean, there are a lot of people who legitimately believe in him, who are Americans just like you. I mean, you cannot pin, you know, a couple rabble-rousers in a crowd on Donald Trump. He doesn't condone the behavior. He has said so. He said
he wanted to punch reporters himself from the stage.
Well, reporters, yes.
Yeah, right. he's called out reporters by name and pointed to them, and, you know.
Listen, I am not defending Donald Trump's words that come out of his mouth, but to blame him or to somehow, you know, paint with such a broad brush that these rallies are, you know, disgusting spectacles is just, it's just not true.
I have to say, I am certainly one of the journalists, one of the observers who didn't properly understand this phenomenon earlier, who just thought, oh, Trump is a reality TV clown. This isn't going anywhere. And it's something that we are all needing to get our minds around. And I think what Kristen's saying is essentially true, which is that this is something that we can't just say, oh, these are just a bunch of uneducated, crazy people who hate all foreigners.
Right.
There's a lot more to what's going on here.
I think Eric Joyn's exactly right. This is John Williams. That's from our Mincing Rascals podcast. And I'm one of those who was late to the message. We're so focused on the shiny object, Donald Trump, at the front of the parade. You forget that all of those people behind him are feeling something. And Kristen McQuarrie was right. Their opinion, their vote is every bit as valid as mine or yours or anybody else that might happen to disagree with some of Trump's tactics. Something's going on here. And instead of focusing on Trump, we should be thinking about or talking about why are all of those people in the crowd angry? So angry that they would actually hitch their wagon to Donald Trump. You can hear the full podcast by subscribing to the Mincing Rascals on iTunes at the store there or by listening to it at WGNplus.com. We call it the Mincing Rascals, and you'll see the icon there. You can listen to it. We post it every Friday. We also post a conversation with Thomas Jefferson. My friend TJ and I still visit every week. You can hear that at WGNplus.com, too, or on my Facebook page. I'm King John on Facebook. Yeah, I asked Jefferson about all of this stuff on Friday as well, and a fresh podcast is there. Let's catch you up on WGN Radio News. That's coming up next.
You have no idea what it means to have nothing. You don't value what we have achieved. I have had to fight for everything my entire life.
I saw a future. Our future.
We had a future until you started destroying it.
Oh, no. Oh, man, that's tough. That's tough. Although you think the House of Cards power couple, I think that it's not him, it's her. I think she is the scariest of the two. Do you agree with me on that? Hi, it's John Williams. You're listening to WGN Radio, and we're talking TV here with Sonia Soraya, who writes about television for Salon. Sonia, it's John Williams. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. That was a really scary clip you just played.
Wasn't it, though? I mean, I haven't even seen that scene, but Frank Underwood's good, but don't you think she's even more, she's capable of even worse. Would you agree on that?
You know, I think that, I wouldn't totally, but I think I know why you would say that. You know, Claire has a little bit more of a conscience in the first few seasons of the show, but she also has more to prove. And I think that she has, she can get really ruthless in pursuit of her goals. We haven't even seen the depths of it, I think. Frankly, sort of, we know what he's capable of, but you feel like with Claire that there's a lot there you haven't yet seen.
I conveniently forget sometimes that early in the run of this show, he murdered somebody, so there's that.
I mean,
he didn't just murder him. He did so... You know, what's the right way to describe how casually he just pushed somebody in front of a train? And you go, well, and it was so clean and neat and didn't seem to trouble him. Has that murder actually haunted him throughout the run of the series? I don't think it has it?
Well, in this recent, the season that just debuted on Friday, I think that for the first time, you really see his conscience starting to prick him.
Okay.
And actually, the actress who played Zoe Barnes, Kate Mara, she comes back and is in a bunch of, like, subconsciousy dream sequences. I don't want to reveal too much about the story for the listeners who haven't seen it yet, but it is really interesting to see him maybe sort of begin to come to terms with it, although I don't know that Frank really regrets any choices he's made.
Yeah, right. But I did get to be president, so that was nice. We're talking, obviously, about House of Cards with Sonia Soraya from Salon, and she was writing about this not just because it's an interesting piece, but you also sort of juxtapose them with the other power couple of our generation, and that's the Clintons. How similar and dissimilar are they? I mean, that's kind of a scathing indictment, isn't it, to say that they are the Clintons or the Clintons are them?
Well, I didn't mean for it to be, although I can see how some people would think it that way. I think it's really that, you know, the fact that Hillary Clinton was a political wife for a large part of her career and then shifted to become a politician herself. I mean, and she was always, you know, a lawyer. She worked throughout, you know, Bill Clinton's early political career in very substantive ways. She was never.
Oh, she spearheaded his health care plan. You're absolutely right.
Right. But I think that we're also very up until that point, and certainly those of you who remember the Bill Clinton election and her comments about like making cookies and making tea at home and how dramatically different that was from what people expected of political wives for many, many years. The fact she really changed that narrative, and I think we see. I think that there are so many different interpretations of that and curiosities on television about like what it must be like to be a woman who is in this circumscribed role in the White House, which is the most powerful place in the world, and to want something more, to want something different. And I think that Claire's journey is an imagining of that, an imagining of wanting to move out of her husband's shadow to be something else. And I think what it reveals is that, as you say, she's very scary. And I think it sort of reveals at least that Frank and Claire are a unit and they accomplish things together. And as much as Frank is the one who holds the office and is the commander of chief and is in the limelight, you know, so much of the show intends to show that Claire is a fundamental part of his success. And in this season, she starts to undermine him because she's mad at him. And you see him completely, like, he can't fight her because he relies on her so much to succeed. So really interesting meditation on marriage, but it's also, I think, really interesting because we know that this, the couple who did something very much like this and is now attempting to do it again in this election are the Clintons. So it is very interesting.
They're a unit. You're absolutely right. I mean, Bill Clinton can hold his own in any room, but it's clear that they were a team, particularly since you now see her emerging as though it's some master grand plan of the Clintons who are power mad. You know, where I vacillate on this, too, and you could say this about the Bushes, you know, that whole dynasty, or the Clintons. You could say these are people who are power grabbers and that we should distance ourselves from that. But there's a part of me that also says, no, really, the reason Hillary Clinton wants to be president, or the Bushes did, or Jeb did, is because they want to serve. I mean, yeah, there's ego, and yeah, there's power, but shoot, you're not going to get rich being president. Think of all of the headaches and heartaches. Think of the pressure. You probably don't aspire that unless you actually do want to do good for the country. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting about House of Cards is that it does sort of showcase like this naked grab for power. But I think something that the show doesn't quite get to, which is very real, is that like, why do people want, like, what are they getting out of this? Like, what is their goal? And there has to be, I think, something more that drives you. I think you're totally right. There's always this, like, a little bit of attention is, like, if the person who really wants to be in charge, are they always, like, the best person to be in charge if they want it that badly? But that seems to be a problem with politics in general.
West Wing sort of dealt with that side of it a little more, and maybe that was Pollyanna-ish. That was through rose-colored lenses. But, you know, the president in West Wing wasn't there because he was power mad. It was because he really wanted to close the pay gap, you know, or help immigrants or whatever the liberal agenda on that show was. So maybe that was, you know, maybe that show would have been a little more authentic too, right? If it had made the desire for power a little more apparent, you know.
Well, it is interesting, right, because that is such a starry-eyed show. I love The West Wing. I've watched it so many times. And I think that they're both responsive to the political climate of their times. You know, The West Wing was written during the end of the Clinton presidency, which was sort of devolving into, like, you know, total inability to get anything done because of a very gridlocked Congress and, of course, the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And it was this vision of this, like, good-hearted, like, scandal-free liberal presidency that became, like, increasingly more important as the Bush administration started and, you know, all of the bleeding-heart liberals, myself included, were feeling like, you know, we didn't really have a voice in Washington anymore. And then meanwhile, I think with House of Cards, which started during, you know, the Obama years, it's almost like the optimism and the altruism that people see in the Obama White House, some people see in the Obama White House, the exact opposite is what we see on House of Cards, which is very, very cynical, sterile view of human nature.
Well, and the argument is, okay, which is more real? You know, which is it West Wing or is it House of Cards or is it our vision of the Obamas or the Bushes or whomever? You really don't know. But, you know, the people, when you talk to those who are on the inside in Washington, will go, it's more like House of Cards than anything you can imagine.
Yeah, they do say that.
I got back. Yeah. But the best thing about West Wing, though, is that at least it gave us Rob Lowe again. And from Rob Lowe, we then get to The Grinder. And The Grinder is the best show ever. Oh, my God. If you do not watch the sitcom The Grinder, just find it and start watching it because Rob Lowe is such a great ham on that
show. He's so good in that role. Yeah.
The whole cast on that show, The Grinder, it's about a TV star, and his show,
he was on a show called The Grinder for many years where he played a lawyer whose nickname was The Grinder because I guess he ground his clients into the dust or something. I mean his opponents into the dust or something. It's a very dumb show, and every episode you actually see a little bit of the fake show. But then what happens in his life is that the show ends, and because he's played a lawyer on TV for a decade, he decides that he can practice law in real life with his brother, who is a lawyer, and his father, who is a lawyer. And, like, the really sad part is that, like, people really respond to the fact that he was a lawyer on TV. It's a great little show.
Sort of like people turning to Marcus Welby, MD, years ago and asking for advice. And he'd say, no, I'm not really a doctor. I play one. But there was so much trust that they actually thought he'd give the medical advice. It's 2:19. Sonia, let's pause for a minute. I want to ask you about a couple of other shows when we return. I want to talk to you about Downton Abbey, the O.J. Simpson series, Walking Dead is back. Let's grind into some of those shows next on WGN. We're talking with Sonia Soraya. She writes about TV for Salon. Are you still there, Sonia, or did you hang up when I started to talk about Costco?
It was really the dinosaurs that got me.
Yeah, right. Fair enough. Well, by the way, you and I have been talking just now about House of Cards, its sort of affinity for the Clintons. But where are we, just real quickly, wrap me up on House of Cards. What season are we? What episode are we? Where are we on the run of that thing?
Oh, well, so the whole fourth season of it dropped on Friday.
Right.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot happened, so I don't know if I want to reveal
That's
too
okay.
much. But, yeah,
fourth
but yeah, so the whole fourth season, I think it's 13 episodes, tons to watch.
The first season, when that dropped, Brenda and I found it and watched it. And like everybody else, you know, just episode, episode, episode. You couldn't not right. wait to get to the next episode. And
right,
then I thought
right.
it just started to slide down. I didn't think two was as good as one, and I didn't think three was as good as two. Maybe three was a little bit better. Would you say mm-hmm. the fourth season is as good as one, or where is it overall?
Yeah, I got to tell you, I think the fourth season might be some of the best work they've done. And I think it... I think that I would agree with you that I think the first season slid a bit for me, but it was my favorite as the show moved forward. Until this season, you know, I watched the first six episodes all in one go, basically, and it's like the suspense of it is like really crazy because, you know, as fans who finished the third season will know, this is when Frank and Claire, that's when they begin to really fight each other. And it's so cool because you just don't know who's going to win. Like, they're both really scary. So I did really enjoy it. It's a melodramatic show, so things get politically implausible, I would say,
somewhere around
episode 8 or 9. But it's also at the point where you're just like, yeah, all right, totally, Claire, go for it. So,
yeah.
You know, it's such an easy show to watch.
Well, his ascendancy to the presidency was so fast that plausibility left a long time ago, and I think you're right. Just either buy in or don't. Just go for the ride or not. You know, speaking of suspense, I've been enjoying Walking Dead, and they opened up one of the, I think it was the last episode, where things are kind of sweet and cheerful. The sun is shining. One of them is going door-to-door, handing out cookies. The monsters are at bay. And whenever they set you up like that, you go, bad things are going to happen. You know, the prettier the beginning, you know, the darker the turn is going to be. I find myself still watching that show and still liking it, though, even though really every episode is pretty much, it's not killing zombies anymore. It's killing other people to the point where I almost think they're starting to get too good at it. They almost enjoy it a little bit. It's sort of their raison d'etre a little bit. And I thought, I wonder if they're going to go there, talk about that issue. But so far, I'd say so good.
Do you think that that's kind of like a Game of Thrones thing happening with the show? Because that's another very violent show that people love.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it in those terms. But I think there are times where they could resolve their issues in a number of ways. And slaughtering the other... Yeah, I know, and that's what it is. It's like, even though this is like another world now, those are, when they're killing other people, you know, those are human beings. That's murder. And I know the courts are gone. It's Lord of the Flies here, but there are times where they could resolve their issues without the most convenient way of just chopping off their heads, and they just do that. And those aren't the people that we were cheering for, you know, in the first season. And so I'm kind of struck by that. That's at least where my head is on that show right now.
That's very interesting. I mean, that show is so big for AMC. It's the most watched cable drama on all of cable. And so I think to some degree, I know that they recently left the comic books that they're based on because I think they like passed them in terms of story. And I think to some degree, the show's just like, we have to keep going. We have to find some way to keep going. We have to keep putting material into the show. So that might be what's happening, too.
Give me your best 30 seconds on the O.J. Simpson series.
Well, this is fun. It's like an elevator pitch.
Yes.
So The People versus O.J. Simpson is an FX show. It's part of what's going to be a bigger show that does like an investigation of different crimes and the crime trials in America. And so The People versus O.J. Simpson, it's based on mostly the Jeffrey Toobin book, Run for His Life, which is kind of the definitive history of the O.J. Simpson trial. And, you know, it's stuff that's 20 years old or a little bit older now. A lot of us remember it. Not all of us were, like, following it that closely, but, you know, you couldn't avoid it. You know, you had to know something about it. I myself was in school when the O.J. Simpson trial was happening. So watching this show, it's sort of like deja vu because they do a really great job of, like, making everyone very, very empathetic and very human, and they get into a lot of the details. They're not even really trying to solve the case so much as they're just trying to show, like, how it became this media circus, you know. So you see, like, you know, like the, like Robert Kardashian shows up, and you see like the little like teenage Kardashian girls, like, you know, they're out to Father's Day brunch with their dad, and like someone recognizes him from the OJ trial, and they're like all super excited about it. They're like, "Dad, are you famous?" And it's so weird because you know like what's going to happen to that. And you were, we were there for this whole trial, and we lived this. But in some ways, it's so crazy to see it happen, you know, in real time, and to sort of begin to appreciate just how bizarre a moment in American history it was.
Yeah, it really was.
I think
it's funny really, you cite that scene, yeah, too, because some people have been critical of that one particularly. It's like we weren't at the brunch, but they did go out to brunch. But then when he turns to what will be the Kardashian clan, and he tells those girls, you know, real happiness isn't being famous. It's about what's doing right. And you thought, oh, come on, really? Why don't we just – can we just get Kim to make a cameo? But by and large, I'm hearing and feeling good things about the series. I'm out of time, and our 30 seconds on that show is up. Come on with me again, Sonia. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's always a pleasure to read you in Salon.
Oh, thank you so much, John. Have a good one.
Sonia Soraya writes for Salon about TV, most recently about House of Cards. It's 2:30. Thank you, Bob Kessler. John Williams on WGN Radio. We're listening to the latest from Gwen Stefani, and it's a song that we put up on VibeScore. We said, hey, what do you make of the new Gwen Stefani song? Get VibeScore. It's an app. One word, VibeScore, VibeScore. You can follow different groups in VibeScore. We'll feed you news or topics of interest to you, and then you get to score them. We score the news with VibeScore. So what did we all think of the new Gwen Stefani song? That one sounded pretty good to me. I'm at an 85. Griff, what did you give the new song by Gwen Stefani?
I'm realizing that I have to wait until seconds before we do this segment to score, because I always change my mind on the music ones. I score them during the week. And then I feel completely different when we're actually talking about it. So I gave it a 68.
What?
I noticed you were a little down on that.
I know. I want to raise it up. I'm in the 80s now.
Yeah, I gave it an 82.
Yeah.
I enjoyed.
But it's lower. I mean, when I voted, the whole timeline's off here now. But when I voted, my 68 raised it up to like a 40. There were some 15s in the mix.
Oh, I know.
People were sitting
at a 47 right now.
We're at a 47
right now. Because here's how people vote for Gwen Stefani music. It's the same way we vote for politicians. We have biases built in, and you aren't always able to hear or see what's in front of you. That's a good song.
I do agree with you. I thought maybe we could go one segment with no politics. Unfortunately,
no. Yeah, really,
not gonna happen. Yeah. Well, yeah, we did kind of do that. But all right, let's try.
So wait,
okay.
I didn't know people had a bias against Gwen Stefani, though.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think they've made up their mind about Stefani. Maybe you're not, you know, I don't think she's offensive to anybody, but she's not maybe so awesome, and then they don't give it a clean listen. That's my interpretation, Decker. I'm going to stick with it. Facts be damned. By the way, Kristen Decker just walked into the studio. Hi, Deck. How are you?
Good. How are you?
This is our VibeScore segment. We always appreciate you coming in and playing the little game here with us.
I love giving my opinion on multiple
Go
things.
Go figure. Well, so in the What's Up category, which is sort of a catch-all basin on VibeScore, we put Erin Andrews and the fact that she got $55 million. She's not going to get $55 million, but that was the settlement amount in that case. So we asked you, what do you think of $55 million for Erin Andrews? If you scored it 100, that would be, yep, we're all in, you go, girl. And if you scored it a 0, that would be, no, 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 wait a minute, that's a ridiculous settlement for what happened there. It's currently trending at a 74, and I was at a 90 on that one. I don't know how much money to put on that, but that one, even though it was a lot, did not seem insane to me, considering what happened. And my last point about this is, if you want to get institutions to change their behavior, you have to hit them with a lot of money. And that's what that does.
I scored it a 94. And I think it really made a statement that their practices sucked and they should have to pay for giving out personal information like, oh, where celebrities' hotel rooms are.
Yeah, no kidding.
So I thought it was an appropriate amount.
Well, the guy's scheme was kind of brilliant. I mean, it's not their policy to give out those room numbers of famous people. They don't give anybody's room number. But he said, hey, I want to use the house phone to call her. Would you mind if I did that? And then he went over to the house phone. He asked them to connect him to her. And when it rang, he saw her room number on the display on the phone. I didn't know they did that. And then he went, aha, now I have a room number. Then he went and asked if he could get the room next to her, and they said okay. Anyway, that's how that happened. But what a story. Okay, let's go from that one to the Downton Abbey finale on TV. I don't think we've ever had a score of 95 for something, but everybody who vibed on the Downton Abbey finale loved it. They gave it a 95. I don't know if you guys watched that, but we did, and I just loved it. Just thought it was terrific.
I'm a couple seasons behind, so I could not vibe on that.
They don't all die.
I have not seen a second of the show. I do remember once in college, an English professor of mine spoiled a major season, like, 3 thing in her lesson, and there was a shudder throughout the class. Like,
oh really?
Because it was a nerdy class, so everybody's watching Downton Abbey, but nobody was up to date on it like we are not. But and there were a lot of votes on it too, so people were uniformly very happy with that finale.
It wasn't like 2 people. But what's the time lag, Griffin? How long do you have to not tell somebody about something these days?
I don't know.
What's the spoiler alert range?
Well,
these
I feel
days?
Like you always ask. Like if you're talking one-on-one with someone, you ask, like, oh, have you seen blah, blah, blah? And then if they say, oh, I'm in season 2 or 3, then you just shut your mouth.
Yeah, but
sometimes these season 2 or 3 would be like, that could be last week, but sometimes it's a year or two ago.
I still think you should spoil it.
No, I think it's on the other person. If you care about that show that much, you'd be up to date. And I am not. I don't practice what I preach here at all. Please don't spoil, you know, whatever good times for me. I need to catch up. But that's how I feel. Maybe that's a question for next week, actually.
Yeah, no kidding. Did you guys watch the Ghostbusters trailer? We didn't need another Ghostbusters. The all-female cast seems condescending to me, really. These women have work without giving them an all-girl movie. And then the trailer isn't even that good.
What's wrong with the trailer?
Oh, my God. It's the exact same movie. It's the same scenes, only now it's women getting the slime on them. And I don't think it looks like a good movie, and I don't even think they look that good in it. Final answer.
I give it an 85, and I liked it. Final answer.
I was at like an 83 because I agree. There was such a negative reaction to this trailer too, and it's a lot of
A 49.
They're not 49. People really like. Well, yeah, that's on our app, but on actual YouTube, there are way more dislikes than there are likes for a video like this. That's kind of unprecedented. And people have reacted so strangely to it, and I don't know what to take from it. But because to me, it looked pretty funny. And also, it's directed by Paul Feig, who is coming off of Bridesmaids, The Heat, and Spy from last year. 3 of the best comedies.
Agreed. Love
the past,
them all.
Yeah, like, you don't do much better than him for a comedy. So I think it's in good hands.
And some
like
of the best female comedians. And also, the special effects are better now, so the ghosts look cooler.
Okay.
Disagree.
That's why we have Vibe Score.
Did you watch the video of the dog driving the little car?
I loved it. It was like puppy in a cup for me.
Welcome back, everybody. Okay, that's getting a 73 on Vibe Score. By the way, Griff, pardon me, I'm just going to throw one of the political questions in here because with all of the, you know, jockeying for position, Ted Cruz has actually made some ground. He's winning some states. I think he is actually going to be the nominee now, even though all along I've been saying Rubio. We said, okay, gang, just give us your vibe for candidate Ted Cruz. A lot of people scored, and he's getting a 10 right now. And by the way, he may be your guy. I'm sorry. Just that's what happened. I mean, it's about Ted Cruz that Saturday Night Live last week, when they were doing the news, they said, no, it was their cold open, and included the line where he says, we're about to show a full picture of the face of Ted Cruz. Viewer discretion is advised. Sorry,
I love
man.
Ted Cruz bad lip reading. Just YouTube that, and you will get the biggest chuckle.
Ted Cruz bad lip reading?
Yes. It's very.
I said,
where
they insert him saying other things, or
yeah, or it's yeah. a, it's not him saying it. It's a different voice, but like to his lips, like the different commercials, and it's just so funny.
I'm trying to think of if I've seen that now. Anyway, Ted Cruz pulling a low number right now. And by the way, President Obama inserting himself into a state political race is, you know, we said, what do you think of that? Barack Obama's actually campaigning for somebody locally. You go, boy, or hey, wait a minute, that's, you should stay out of something that parochial. And he's getting a 37 on that. That's about where I put it, too. And that's the way we play Vibe Score. All right. Anything else from you, Ms. Decker?
You always leave my highest scoring post off the list, but oh, the no, wireless earbuds.
Oh yeah,
almost
right.
Gave it 100. Gave it a 98 because it's
wireless earbuds
genius.
Are pulling a 72 in the business and technology. So in business and technology on VibeScore, we say, okay, here's something new in technology. What do you think of this new product? It's sort of like what we do for Lou Manfredini, his new to Lou segment on the radio. We always feature on VibeScore. It's a link to that item. It's a video about that item. And then we say, what do you think? This week, Lou has a new stud finder, which he just loves. And you can vibe on that as well. Okay, that's it. We'll talk to you again next week. Kristen, thanks for popping in.
No problem.
The boys from The Beat say hi next on WGN. The guys are getting ready to talk sports on The Beat. Adam Hoge wandered into the studio. Adam, how are you?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Good. We got just you, or is Carmen around?
Carb just literally ran through the door right as you were saying hi to me.
Don't you hate it? That's something that the listeners didn't need to know, John, but yes, I did.
No, they needed to know it. They needed to know.
I hate when I have to talk sometimes and I'm out of breath because I've been running down the hall, and then you're reading a spot or something, and it's impossible to catch your wind. So we won't talk to you on this segment, Mark, if that helps.
Well, I was actually just strolling and chewing on a toothpick and thinking about my life, so I'm good.
You're pretty chill right now?
I'm easy. Always easy, John.
You know, I'm kind of excited, guys, because I'm going to see the Warriors play the Timberwolves.
Wow.
I know, a week from Monday. And, you know, so I get to see the Steph Curry show. And I was wondering what you guys thought about this. Is Curry playing basketball better than almost anybody has ever played their respective sport?
He's playing. The thing that I love about Steph, John, is that he's
excluding defense, by the way. But
right.
Keep going.
Well, right. He's changing the way the game is played. I mean, you're talking about kids now looking at, whoa, that little guy out there is hitting 40-foot bombs. Maybe I could do that too. Now then they'll find out that dribbling behind your back and cutting one way and cutting the other way, and then flipping a shot over a 6'5". Defender is not going to be too easy to do, but he does. It's like he's opening up a possibility that was never there before, because, you know, you could see like Isaiah Thomas or somebody driving the lane and somehow ridiculously make a layup. But here it's like, oh, well, maybe I could actually do that, and it can be effective. It's unbelievable the way he's playing the game. No one's ever played like him.
Yeah. And the way he's making some of these 40 and 50 foot shots, you know, I mean, that's really, I think, what inspired me to ask that question. Some people hit threes. Kyle Korver was leading the league for a couple of years in 3-point shots, but 40 footers? I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, I would say he's sort of revolutionizing his position and maybe playing his position better than it's ever been played. Although I don't even know where to put him exactly, because he's just doing something that really no one else in the game has ever done before.
And you have also, John, like some of the greatest players that ever played the game. Oscar Robertson is who I'm talking about right now, coming out and saying that coaches don't know how to coach today. That clearly, if I was guarding Steph Curry, you would just get up and body him. Well, which is actually what the Warriors want you to do. I mean, there's just no way to defend this guy, because if you do get up on him, he's going to go past you, and then he's going to get everybody else involved, or he's going to get a layup. So you actually want him shooting the 30-foot shot and just have to live with it. But he's shooting 50% from 30-plus feet.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? And you know he's going to shoot the shot. I mean, I know you could dribble by him. You've got to respect that a little bit. But you got a pretty good guess when he's going to pop that thing. Everybody does, and he's still making half of them. I suppose what gets lost in this conversation, though, is how good the players are around him, right? I mean, you have to respect other players on that team, too.
That's true, but And we kind of got it in the matchups a couple of weeks ago. We, Carbon and I, actually matched up the 95-96 Bulls against this Warriors team. Who would guard who? Who would? I still think overall the Bulls are a better team. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is, yes, this Warriors team is good. There's other good players around Steph Curry. But, I mean, you take Curry out of the equation. I don't know that the Bulls have as much success as – or I don't know if the Warriors have as much success as the Bulls did in those 2 years in the 90s when MJ wasn't there.
That's an
really?
That's an interesting
really? Comment. I mean, that's two different ways to have that conversation.
Yeah.
One is, all right, an interesting way to judge the teams would be take out the two superstars. You think the Bulls without Jordan were better than this Warriors team without Curry?
I think so. I mean, they still made it pretty far in the playoffs and had a chance to
you had
right? Am I wrong?
To be honest with you, I don't know. Where are you on this, Mark? Because to be honest with you, I think this Warriors team is better than that Bulls team. Maybe I forgot, but wow.
I had a very spirited conversation at the last Bulls game I covered, John, with Sam Smith, who wrote the Jordan Rules, and everybody knows Sam's coverage at Bulls.com. And, I mean, this is one of the great historians of the game, let alone writing today. And, I mean, he was emphatic, and as we went through the matchup, saying, listen, Scottie Pippen is going to guard Steph Curry, and he's going to come across half court. He's going to see a 6'8 guy, and Michael's going to guard Clay, and it's not going to be close. But, you know, back to your actual question of who's better, I mean, that Bulls team, you're talking about Pippen and Kukoc and Rodman. It's and even, you know, Ron Harper's a functional player. I think they beat Golden State. If you take Curry off and if you take Michael off, I think the Bulls win.
What else are you guys talking about this afternoon?
Well,
it's been a busy week for the Bears, so we're going to start with free agency and what's going on with the Bears. They added another linebacker today, which I think has fans excited. It's a big weekend in college basketball, too, so we got to dive into some March Madness and Selection Sunday.
That and Bryce Harper claims that that bat flips are good for the game. Where do you come out on that, John? Because we're looking forward to that conversation.
I think, first of all, if you're going to do it, have a good flip. You know, this Byung-ho Park that's new, he plays for the Minnesota Twins, and we were actually talking about this on Friday in Minnesota. My advice to him would be go ahead and do your fancy bat flip late in the season after you've hit your 35th home run. But don't do it early. Don't do it as a rookie. And don't do it on your first or second home run. You know, act like you've been there before. I don't know.
But so
a little flair for the game.
So when Jose Bautista, the Toronto Blue Jays, has his bat flip in the big moment in the playoffs, does that bother you?
That one did not. No, that one did not. I mean, it seems so genuine. I don't know. I didn't lose my mind about that the way other people did.
Right. That was, to me, in the moment.
Yes.
After you hit the second biggest home run in that franchise's history.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So, but if you do it, an ordinary home run and you're flipping the bat, then you don't do it, Adam. Then you don't get to flip the bat.
See, I'm actually a big bat flip guy. I like him. Brett Boone, remember Brett Boone? He had that little flip every single time he hit a home run. I don't have a huge problem with it in general.
If it's 10-1, you should have a drop of a little bit in the moment that if you hit a home run, it's kind of embarrassing at that point and don't do the bat flip. But outside of that, like, you can't hit like a game-winning homer in April and think, oh, yeah, by the way, yeah, you're right. It is only April the 15th. I can't do this now.
Yeah.
Like.
All right, they're shutting me up, and you guys too. So have a good show. I'm going to get us into news here in a minute, but thanks for coming by, guys.
Thanks, John.
It's 2:59. This is WGN.